this year look like for you? A year full of promise. And if that promise is to be realized, then for most of us, that starts today. So New Year's Day is a great day to reset, isn't it? To recalibrate, take a bit of stock on what's going on in your life, and perhaps set some new goals for yourself. Perhaps some goals that have been on ice for a while, things that have drifted into the background, perhaps revisiting some of those goals that you set this time last year or this time 2 years ago, and re-embracing those into your life. See, with all good intentions, many of us set our New Year's resolutions today or this coming week. 2023, what will it look like for you? Will this be your year to shine? Will this be your year to sort of persist and to hang in there? Will this be the year for breakthrough? Will this be your time to deliver? I wonder what it's going to be for you. What are you going to be setting for yourself this year? Perhaps for some of you, this is the year where you're going to be on time. Who's going to be on time this year? You're always 5 minutes late, aren't you, to things? You're going to be on time. I see a few hands up. Perhaps you're going to be more organized this year. You're going to use a daily planner and perhaps a diary. That's going to be you. Perhaps some of you are going to complete that study that you put on hold 2 or 3, 4 years ago. Perhaps some of you are going to complete that half-finished renovation at home. Who's going to do that? Come on. I see a few digs in the ribs there. Finish it. Start today when you get home. And for others of you, perhaps this is going to be the year where you're going to shed a few kilos and embrace that healthy exercise plan, that healthy eating plan. Perhaps this year is going to be a year where you read the Bible more. Perhaps it's going to be a year where you identify that person of peace in your life and invite them to read the Bible with you. Perhaps this is going to be a year where you're going to put your hand up and invest in the life of the church and use your gifts and serve. Perhaps this is going to be a year where you embrace a spiritual mentor into your life to help you with your spiritual walk. Perhaps this is the year to apply for that dream job. What is it for you? What will 2023 look like for you? Will it be a year where you step into your calling, a year to persist, a year of breakthrough? Well, today we're going to look at a very favorite Old Testament story, and we find a young woman who is challenged by this very notion. Will she step into her calling? Will she persist and hang in there until breakthrough may come? It's a story of Esther, and she faces a huge, huge challenge. Will this be her time to deliver? The story kicks off in approximately 474 BC. The setting is King Xerxes' palace in Susa there. It's a major city of Persia. I'm going to paraphrase a story because it's quite a long one. You'll find it there in the book of Esther. But there are four main characters, a couple of cameos in there too, but generally four main characters to this story. First of all, you've got King Xerxes, the ruler of the Medo-Persian Empire. Then you've got his second in charge, the 2IC, Haman. Haman yields a fair bit of responsibility and a fair bit of power, as you'll soon see. And so he's part of the command there in the empire. Then you have Esther, this young, beautiful Jewish woman who wins the favor and the approval of the king, and he makes her his queen. And then you've got Mordecai, this Jewish government official, Esther's cousin, who adopts Esther to be his own daughter after her parents die. And the story goes like this, that at some point in time, Mordecai refuses to bow down and honor Haman. So in Haman's eyes, this is totally disrespectful and there needs to be retribution. But this is not just small level punishment that Haman comes up with here. He's enraged by this lack of disrespect that came his way. So he's looking for a way to kill not only Mordecai for his disrespect, but all the Jewish people, his people. And so this is where you'll see the power that he has. He persuades, he tricks in many ways, persuades King Xerxes to issue a decree to kill, destroy, and annihilate all the Jewish people in the region on the 13th day of the 12th month. And Mordecai gets wind of this. And in so doing, he responds by tearing his clothes, putting on ash cloth and sackcloth and ashes, and he runs out into the city, into the public space, wailing bitterly and loudly. And he goes as far as the king's gate, but he doesn't enter it because no one wearing sackcloth is permitted to enter past that point. So Esther learns of Mordecai's behavior and she's a little puzzled by it, so she sends him some clothes to put on. But Mordecai refuses to wear that clothing. So Esther, still puzzled, sends Hathach. This is one of those cameo roles in this story. Hathach, one of her eunuchs, go out and find out what's wrong with Mordecai. Why is he behaving so irrationally? So Mordecai tells Hathach all that had happened and actually shows him a copy of the decree to show Esther. So Mordecai tells him to go back and urge Esther to go into the king's presence, beg for mercy, and plead with him for her people, that he wouldn't go through with this evil plan to kill and destroy all the Jewish people. So Hathach goes back and reports this back to Esther, all that Mordecai had said. She instructs Hathach, though, to tell Mordecai, I can't do that. So in other words, at first, Esther pushes back. She hasn't got ears for Mordecai's initial request, because this is a dangerous request that he's putting before her. To enter the king's presence is a no-no. Could be a death sentence for her. Any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned has to be put to death. Now here's the unique situation that Esther finds herself in. Here she is, the queen, but it's been 30 days since she'd been summoned to the inner court. So Mordecai, again, kicks back with this response in Esther 4:13-14. Don't think that because you are in the king's house that you alone of all Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to a royal position for such a time as this. Now, it appears that these words really hit the spot for Esther, unlike the initial request that Mordecai had of her. Now, God's obviously doing a number on her, because look at her response now back to Mordecai. In verse 16, go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Well, what a story. We've just got a small glimpse of it there in that paraphrase, but this is an incredible story. It's got power, it's got suspense, it's got romance, it's got intrigue. This has got all the hallmarks of a best-selling novel or a mini-series of sorts that you watch on television with the title The Girl Least Likely. This young orphan girl who finds herself in the most unlikely of places. See, King Xerxes had banished Queen Vashti from his life and from his palace because apparently she disobeyed a request that he had made of her. So she disrespected him and he tosses her out of the palace and out of her position. And so not long after this, he sets up his own version, his own Persian version of The Bachelor. This is what he does. I mean, he sends out word to all into the surrounding areas. He brings in all the most beautiful women from the surrounding regions and brings them into his harem. And there he will judge them one by one, but there could only be one winner. And it's Esther that catches his eye. Esther's the one that wins his favor after this process of elimination. So he offers her his rose and she accepts. Now, and any alternative response would have spelt disaster for her. She really had no other option than to accept that rose. Now, I say rose symbolically because it wasn't a rose. If you look at the back end of chapter 2, you'll see it was a crown that Esther was presented with. And then a huge banquet was thrown in her honor. Yet even at that point, she keeps her nationality and her background a total secret. So here we have Esther in a position that she would not have even conceived was probable or possible for a girl like her and from her background and her race. Yet God is orchestrating something here. He's got her exactly where he wants her, and she doesn't even realize it. She doesn't even know why. I've got no doubt in the ensuing weeks and months and years, she would have been questioning God. God, how did I get here? And why on earth am I here? What's my purpose? I don't feel really loved by this king. I don't really feel like a wife in the sense of the pure word. Why am I here, God? No doubt she was asking those questions. And God will often place us, when you think about it, in situations that have you questioning why. How many of us have questioned God over time in different seasons of our life? Why, God, why? Most of us have done that, haven't we? Why have you got me here? For what purpose? And even after a hard slog, you continue to question why. But then eventually, something breaks open and you realize what God was doing. That you're indeed there for a purpose, that this is your time. And often it's in retrospect, hindsight, isn't it? We will look back and we can see God's fingerprints over it all, yet at the time, you couldn't see those fingerprints at all. And I've seen this unfold in my life a number of times in a variety of seasons of my life. And one case in point was a season that I spent back in Adelaide I was pastoring over there. And I also became involved in the AFL world as a sports chaplain to the Adelaide Crows. Now, I haven't shared this testimony with you since I've been here over the last 3 years. So if you indulge me, I'll spend a little more time on it this morning because I trust it encourages those of you who are involved in a situation right now, and perhaps you've been involved for a long time and you're thinking of giving up. You're questioning God, why? Surely I could be more productive with my time. I think I'm going to finish up now, because breakthrough hasn't come. Well, I trust this is encouraging to you. So we moved to Adelaide, Tanya and I and the kids, just over 10 years ago now, to a church, Clovercrest Baptist, to be their senior pastor for nearly 7 years. And there's no doubt God sent me across there to help this church up out of the situation, the state that it found itself in. It was a wonderful 7 years. We loved our time there. But one thing I've always been encouraged to do is to be involved in one thing outside of the life of the church where I can give back into the community, use my gifts, particularly around amongst people who don't know Jesus, and to use my passion in so doing. So the vehicle for me has been sport. Love sport. Sport chaplaincy has been one of those things. And so I pitched for the role as a sports chaplain to the Adelaide Crows. It's a volunteer role. It's not a paid role. Over the course of about 18 months, because they'd never had a chaplain before. They didn't really understand it. And long story short, I eventually was invited to become their chaplain. I was the first chaplain of that club, and they were the only AFL club at that time that had never had a chaplain. So their understanding of chaplaincy was pretty minimal, yet they allowed me in to a certain degree. But I must say, for the first couple of years there, it was just a hard slog. I felt isolated. I felt pushed away. Here's the interesting thing. The CEO came to me one day and said to me, "Oh, I believe you're our new chaplain. That's all good. You're not to talk to the players." Wow. I'm not sure how you become a chaplain and you can't talk. What he meant was, we're going to put you in the cafe, and if the players have a spiritual ache, they'll know where to go. Well, not too many players got spiritual aches, I must say. In my first couple of years, I lived a pretty lonely existence in that cafe for those couple of years. Really, what I was there for was insurance, a bit like a dentist. You got a toothache, you go to the dentist, you got a spiritual ache, hey, you can go to the chaplain, he's there for you if you want. But it was very nominal. So I would often cry out to God, why? I felt irrelevant, I wasn't allowed into the rooms, I couldn't celebrate with the players, I couldn't commiserate with them after a loss, and I'm thinking, why am I here, God? I'd often shout out in my prayers, God, what's the purpose? What's the point in even being here? Surely I could use my time more productively and effectively than this, even outside of the church. I repeatedly want to give up. I had good reason to give up. Yet I sensed that I'd been called into this role, and I needed to keep pressing in and finding out why. And also I knew that there had been prayer warriors right across Adelaide and South Australia praying that this role would eventually be fulfilled. About 20 years worth of prayer, and I felt like if I walked away, I'd be letting a lot of people down, letting a lot of prayers down too. So even though I was feeling dry, irrelevant and frustrated, wanting to give up, I was being primed, and God had me exactly where He wanted me, and I didn't even know it. I'll never forget heading into another pre-season training session. It was, I think, my third or fourth season thereabouts, convinced that this was it. I mean, surely they're going to vote me off the island because I've been no use to them, really. Why would they need me through their eyes? And so I was convinced that this was that day they were going to get rid of me. And I was in the car praying, God, another pre-season. Do I really want to go through like the last couple? Perhaps this is my time. And I was praying to God, show me if I'm here, if I'm meant to stay. As I rock up into the car park, a staff member starts walking towards me. I'm thinking, oh, this is the moment. This is the moment I've been preparing for. I think he's going to make it easy for me. I'll get out of the car, and to my great surprise, he goes, oh, Rev, I'm glad you're here. We've just told the players that Dean Bailey, our assistant coach, has got cancer. We're going to need you. Wow. That's the first time I'd heard those words. It was the first time I'd even felt those words. We're going to need you. And this was an opportunity for me to step up and become a pastoral presence in this club and walk with them over the course of 4 months. Dean was diagnosed in the November. Young, fit, 48-year-old, dead 4 months later at Easter. Walking with the club, partially caring for the club, helping them navigate this really hard time for them. And actually walking with Dean and his family, literally, visiting him a lot in hospital, preparing him for death, having profound conversations around Jesus and the cross and the Easter period that we were experiencing together and preparing him for the next life in many ways. And then conducting the funeral at the Adelaide Oval for that family. Things changed for me dramatically from that point on in the club. Fast forward 18 months later. 18 months later, I get another call. It's 4 a.m. in the morning on a Friday morning. Someone from the club rings me and said, "Oh, Rev, can you quickly get down to the club? We've just been told that our coach, Phil Walsh, has been murdered overnight." You might remember that story. It had national coverage, didn't it, a few years ago now. And this was absolutely huge. I mean, this was a rug pulled out from everyone sort of stuff. No one saw this coming. When Dean passed away, it was a deep sadness, but we sort of sensed it was coming as you journey cancer. This was a deep shock. No one saw this coming. Here we were at the Adelaide Oval training for the game on the weekend on the Thursday afternoon. The very next morning, the players are waking up to find out he's been murdered by his very own son. Okay, you might remember that was through a psychosis that he had been diagnosed with and a mental health issue. Yet that's how it occurred. So this was a huge challenge for me as the chaplain, to be with the players as they were told and as they were grieving, to then speak to the club and the staff about grief and the process of grief, and then meet with the Walsh family as I prepared to lead another very high profile funeral in that town. It was tough, but a genuine privilege too as chaplain. A funeral where I was able to speak of the hope that we have in Christ in times of grief, in front of hundreds and hundreds of mourners, and to pray a prayer for the family, and at the request of the wife, Meredith, even pray a prayer for the son, the perpetrator of that murder. I remember looking out that day, just before the service starts, just looking out today, in a room not unlike this size, actually, for about 1,000 people here at the Adelaide Oval, and I got quite nervous. Just before it started, as I looked out, I was recognising all these people. I didn't have a relationship with them, but I recognised them because they all had public profiles. There was politicians and there was police commissioners and there was Eddie Maguire, and because he goes everywhere. And then we had the AFL, the who's who of the AFL industry, and CEOs and business people. They were all there. I got really nervous. I sensed this quiet voice whisper in my ear. It was God saying, "Mark, it's okay. I've got your back. I prepared you for this moment. This is your wheelhouse. Just walk in your gifting." And I felt this peace come about me, and away we went. And there in the back row, never experienced this before, media from all the radio stations and all the television stations, clipboards in hand, taking notes of everything that was said in that service, including all of my words, and then reciting those words in the papers and across the news cycle the next 24, 48 hours. And as I had some profound conversations with people that day, particularly post the service, and as I walked back to the car that day, it was those words that we read there in Esther's story. And God reminded me of that biblical phrase that he'd been preparing me for such a time as this. You know, over those 18 months between those two funerals in particular, I was embraced by the club. I became part of the family. The role was validated. I was validated. I was involved. I was welcomed into the rooms and well beyond the cafe now. I could step into the rooms and into the club, and I was given codes and a whole variety of things that just changed dramatically for me, because trust started to grow and people started to understand my heart for them. And here's the irony. That CEO that told me not to actually talk to the players, he came and offered me a job. He actually wanted to remunerate me for what I was doing in the club. Now, as chaplains, we want to be volunteers and keep it that way. So I resisted that, although I did ask for a car pass in that moment. I was a bit tired of walking 2 kilometres to the game all the time, parking out there. So I thought I'd strike a little while the iron was hot. But some wonderful opportunities then started to evolve in time as I got to invest in the lives of people over those months. I remember sitting with a staff member in a cafe who at the end of that second funeral said to me, "There's got to be more to life than what I'm doing. You know, I'm living the life, I love this job and it's a dream, but there's got to be more to life than this." And we unpacked that as he journeyed back towards faith. And that was a really profound conversation I was able to have with him and even beyond that. Then the players, I remember the players coming up to our church. I've got some good friends from Clovercrest this morning. The Przinski family, it's great to have you guys here from our last church. And you might remember this. We had a fire relief centre that we set up in the church in response to the Adelaide Hills fires. Well, all the Adelaide Crows players came up to our church to pack these food hampers, and not just pack them, then put them in their cars and drive them up into the Adelaide Hills and deliver them to these fire-affected families. It's quite amazing. Those of you who are AFL buffs, you might be looking at it and thinking, is that Patrick Dangerfield there in the white shirt? Yes, it is, before he became a Geelong Cat, just before he left Adelaide. That's Jake Lever next to him there too. And so that was wonderful to get them involved in some of the things that we were doing in church life. I was invited to have lunch with the players after training. So I go to the main training sessions and start sitting down and building relationships with them and having lunch with them and actually getting involved at training and on match day, carrying the balls. And they realised, it took them about 3 years to work this out, but pastors do more than just do funerals and weddings and talk. They actually can move. they can actually run. I remember one day I was running across the Adelaide Oval and this guy came up to me in a bit of a frazzled. I thought there was something wrong because you were running. I said, I run. That's what we do. It's okay. I'm okay. So I started running and I started kicking balls with the players, which is what I still do now with the Essendon Footy Club. And that's the right team to be chaplain for, mind you, just quietly. And so I got involved in match day as well, and I love that aspect of the role, because you can't always be having deep meaningfuls with people or responding to grief when it comes along. You want to get involved in the small things as well and just help out and serve where you can. Got involved in doing some weddings. And so Sam Jacobs there, our big then ruckman, doing his wedding back there in Adelaide. And I've done a number of Adelaide players' weddings back in Melbourne. We've gone back and done some weddings there. Why? Because of that bond that we have together now, based on those couple of years of grief that we went through together. So that's been a real privilege to do, not just the funerals, but the weddings as well. And then it was interesting during that period of time, the media did a lot of stories. There was Channel 9, Channel 10 did a bit of a profile story on myself and the role, and the Adelaide Advertiser, which is like the Herald Sun equivalent, did a big story, back page, validating chaplaincy, which was really timely, because at the time, chaplaincy in schools was really on the nose and being questioned in South Australia. And this came at a really good time where it validated the role of a chaplain in the sporting setting. I then, a couple of years ago, later had to move back to Melbourne, and they had no qualms in certainly going to another chaplain, replacing me with a good friend of mine who's still there today. But I remember one place saying to me at the end of all of this, at the end of, I think it was Walshy's funeral, to me, Rev, I'm not particularly religious, but I reckon you're here for a reason. And he was right. I was there for a reason. Imagine if I'd given up in those first two and a half years where I felt irrelevant, where I felt pushed to the side, where I wasn't told I could talk to anyone, where things just weren't happening, where I felt absolutely of no benefit whatsoever. Imagine if I had just walked away. I would have missed all of those opportunities to minister to people at crucial times in their lives. You see, God knew exactly what he was doing, even if I didn't. And he had me exactly where he wanted me. He had me there for a purpose. It didn't make sense to me, but it made sense to him. I just needed to hang in there. You see, we can't always see God at work in our lives, around our situations, but we must learn to trust him. And you might be questioning even now, as you move into 2023, why God has positioned you in a certain job or a school setting, or a university setting, or even a certain family context you're finding yourself in, and it's really, really tough. You're not really looking forward to it. You don't particularly enjoy it. You're feeling compromised. You might be even overwhelmed by the perceived darkness that is around you. Surely, there is an easier, more productive way that you could operate in life. Is it possible God is saying, no, I have you exactly where I want you. Exactly where I want you. Just trust me. Hang in there. Stay the course. Be patient, and things will break open in time. My time, not yours. You see, for Esther, that's what's happening for her. In time, it actually makes sense. Although there's this battle obviously raging within her initially. Because here you've got Esther taken from her family. She's forced to marry a pagan king where she's not feeling loved. And she's forced to live in this palace where she's living more like a prisoner than she is a queen. And then suddenly she's presented with this huge dilemma. Her people are under threat. The evil Haman has tricked the king in concocting this plan to kill all the Jewish people, her own race, putting them to death. What's she going to do with that? Now, this was based on revenge, obviously, as Mordecai had refused to bow down to Haman at the time. But it wasn't just Mordecai that was going to pay for this. It was the entire race that would suffer for Mordecai's disrespect. So Mordecai tells Esther of Haman's plans and pleads with her, please, Esther, please do something. Step up, speak up, please. And what he's doing there is reminding Esther, or asking her, to use her position of influence and to use it well. Well, at first, Esther plays down this sense of influence. She doesn't want to know about it, because according to Persian law, she could not even go to her husband, the king, without prior approval. As I said earlier, it had been 30 days since she'd been to him. I mean, try and get your head around that as a wife. And if she did, and he didn't want to see her, instant killing, gone. So initially it appears that Esther's really, really shaky. But who knows that we all need Mordecais in our lives who are willing to stick their hand up and stick their neck out and challenge us and give us the hard word when we need to hear it most. That's what Mordecai does here. He could have just sort of backed off, retreated, and tried to work it out another way or just succumbed to the plan that was going to evolve. But no. Mordecai is not satisfied with Esther's response. So he pushes back and says to her, "Don't you think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of the Jews will escape? For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish." See, what Mordecai is saying here is if she chooses to do nothing, that's her choice. But there'll be no escape for her. And God will simply find another way. And that reminds us that God is limited. He's not limited by whether we obey him or we don't. To obey him, to step up and exercise courage is not easy. But to fail in doing so means rebellion against God. And God's work will still be accomplished. I love Mordecai's faith. He's believing that God will still restore and bring his people to pass. So it will still be accomplished. But we suffer the loss of not being involved in it and suffer the wrath of God for our disobedience. And just like Esther, we can hesitate, can't we, sometimes? We can sit on our hands and pretty much do nothing, even though we feel a sense to step up into our calling at times and step into our faith and make it known. You think about it, sometimes you might be at work and your boss is operating really unethically and immorally, treating people unfairly, maybe even doing some illegal stuff. What do? Do you speak up and risk the sack, or do you remain silent to preserve your job? Or perhaps you're part of a pack of friends at school or at university or maybe in a social setting somewhere, and this pack enjoy gossiping, enjoy putting people down and slandering people and going on and on and on about them. What do? Do you speak up and protect the vulnerable? Do you speak up and speak for those that can't speak for themselves? Or do you remain silent so you won't be excommunicated from this elitist pack that you're a part of? You see, as Christians, we're faced with these dilemmas every day of our lives. And we have a message of hope, Christ within us. And just like Esther, we are offered the opportunity to make a stand in our lives and be a witness both in word and in deed. When faced with these difficult situations and huge challenges, to not run away, but to face our fears head on and take that leap of faith, to be courageous and to act. And God will be your portion when you do so. He will be your enough. You need to hear that. In 2023, God will be your portion. He will be enough for you. Whatever he's called you to, whatever context you find yourself in, God will be enough. He will be your strength. And Mordecai reminds Esther of this in chapter 4, verses 14 there, where he says to her, "And who knows, but that you have come to a royal position for such a time as this." So Esther comes to realize that God has placed her in the palace for such a time as this. All the hours of loneliness, all that separation from family and friends, all that wrestling with God, you know the wrestling that we often do with God, all of that wrestling, it all makes sense to her now. Because now she could step up into her calling and save her people and save herself in so doing. Then Esther then sends this reply to Mordecai, "Go then, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And my attendants will fast with you. And when this is done, I'll go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." What incredible courage in that moment, putting her life on the line. She's going to act knowing that this could be the last thing that she does. Esther was faced with a decision to opt in or to opt out. And as people of faith, we are faced with these opt-in or opt-out decisions regularly, aren't we? I mean, it's going to take courage for some of you to opt into your marriage in 2023. Those marriages are just hanging on by a thread. Takes courage to opt in and reclaim that marriage and with all humility go back in, seek forgiveness and recommit to the change and loving your spouse again. It's going to take courage in 2023 to stand up and profess your faith in a relationship or in a work setting where you know if you do, you're going to get hit back. You're going to get stymied in many ways. But to stand up in 2023, particularly in this politically correct and intolerant society that we live in, where offense is easily taken, particularly to our Christian beliefs and our Christian values, and to take courage this year to stand by those convictions and live them and to speak them. See, Esther shows us all the way here. She meets her challenge head on, and instead of running from it, she embraces that challenge. She steps up, and with all courage, she'll take Haman on and risk her life in doing so. God's clearly at work in her life here, very much so. This is her time to step into this calling that God has on her. This is her time to shine in many ways. And I also love the way, don't miss this, I love the way she asks her people to pray. This would be a dangerous mission, so she's going to need a lot of prayer support all around her. So she enlists the help of the prayer warriors of the region, doesn't she? So instead of rushing ahead, which we can often do, hey, act first, pray later, she puts it all to prayer and then acts. So prayer would be integral to a godly outcome. She defaults to prayer and then goes for it. Esther seizes the moment here. She doesn't cower in a corner hoping that God will miraculously just step in for her and fix it all for her. She acts with the hope that God will deliver her people. So she opts in. She steps into a calling instead of playing it safe, which we can so often do, hey? Opting out and preserving self-interest. And as you read on in the story, you'll see there that God indeed comes through. Haman is dealt with, and Esther's courage becomes the catalyst in this huge win for her people. So again, I say, on this day, the first day of 2023, you have been brought to this place for such a time as this, for a purpose. Chase after that purpose this year, won't you? And hang in there. There'll be times this year where you'll just need to hang in there, to persist, even when it's dry, even when it's tough. Breakthrough is coming. Now, I say that. On the flip side, I also understand that there are times when God does genuinely call us on to something different or something again because we've exhausted everything that he's called us to do. When you think about it, even Jesus himself said, "It is finished," and went to the cross. He could have lived another couple of years. It is finished. It had been completed. So for us, there'll be times of completion in our lives where God calls us onto something. But I reckon we have to put the one against the other. Too often we are tempted to walk away from something too early, too soon, before those things evolve that God has for us in our lives. See, opting out is real easy. In 2023, you'll be tempted to opt out because it appears attractive. Persevering and opting in is often, though, where the growth comes from. It's often where the character is built. It's often where the fruit emanates. It's where breakthrough eventually comes. And that's a word that each of us need to heed and be encouraged by as we step into this brand new year. Now, I'll finish with this. I read a story once there about a church in Europe who was unfortunately on the receiving end of a bombing raid in World War II. And the whole of the church property was affected as a result, and the church building was totally demolished, gone, nothing left of it. And at the front of the property was a statue of Jesus, who also suffered as a result of this bombing raid. Now, the statue became disfigured because the arms and the hands of Jesus were gone, been blown off this statue. And so the townspeople get together, and they're working out what bits and pieces of the town they need to rebuild. Of course, the church was part of that discussion, and there was no question that the church building needs to be rebuilt. But the question also came to the church members, do we need to tear down the rest of that statue and rebuild the statue of Jesus at the front of your property? And the church members resisted that very move. They wanted the statue to remain exactly how it was. Why? So it would remind them, the church, that they were to be the arms and the hands of Jesus. You see, as Jesus followers, what an incredible opportunity we have in 2023 to make Jesus known, to be a shining light wherever God has placed you, whether it makes sense or not, to be that shining light that we can be. And he's got you there for a purpose, to be his arms, to be his hands, and it may not always make sense this year. You may feel like you're not making any inroads, that it's tough, that it's dry, you're feeling irrelevant, you're getting impatient. You might even get insulted and ridiculed by people around you. And you might even start fighting with God at different times this year. Why, God, why? There'll be times where opting out is really attractive in 2023. But I want to encourage you with this, that God has called you for such a time as this, to be his hands, to be his feet, to be the mouthpiece of Jesus, and to step into your calling, to hang in there by faith, believing that God is preparing you for great things. He's preparing you for his purposes and for kingdom breakthrough. May that breakthrough come to you in 2023. Let's pray together. Lord God, what an incredible and powerful story we've been reminded of this morning through the story of Esther. What courage and obedience and perseverance. And our prayer is that each of us, we may model those very attributes in our own lives as we step into our calling afresh this year. And I pray particularly for those, even now as they're stepping into a new year, wanting to give up already. Perhaps second-guessing the context they found themselves in, feeling disillusioned. God, would you embed a spiritual resilience in such people, in each of us, a deep faith that brings that things will break open, that there will be breakthrough around the corner at some point in time, and that you are preparing each of us for what is to come. And would you cultivate with us a spiritual character, a growth that comes even when things are dry, when things are tough, where we're bearing no apparent fruit. Because we know that's often where the biggest growth comes from. Would you continue to grow us, even in the midst of the barren land? That we might step into this year, this new year, with great conviction, claiming the victory and the fruit that will come. And praying not just for the courage to hang in there, but like Esther, the courage to act. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.